Welcome to SCOTUScast, a project of the Federalist Society for Law and Public Policy Studies. Our contributors join us from around the country to bring you expert commentary on U.S. Supreme Court cases as they are argued and decisions are issued. The Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker.
Thank you for joining us for this post-decision episode of SCOTUScast. I'm your host, Spencer Caron. On January 14, 2021, the Supreme Court decided City of Chicago, Illinois versus Fulton. The question presented was whether an entity that is passively retaining possession of property in which a bankruptcy estate has an interest has an affirmative obligation under the Bankruptcy Code's automatic stay, Section 362 of the Code, to return that property to the debtor or trustee immediately upon the filing of the bankruptcy petition. The debtors believed that a different provision of the code obligated the city to return the cars as soon as they filed for bankruptcy relief. The bankruptcy court agreed, and later, the Seventh Circuit affirmed that ruling. By a vote of 8-0, the Supreme Court vacated and remanded. Writing for the court, Samuel Alito indicated that, quote, "The mere retention of estate property after the filing of a bankruptcy petition does not violate Section 362A3 of the Bankruptcy Code," end quote. Justice Alito's opinion was joined by all other members of the court except Justice Barrett, who took no part in the consideration or decision of this case. Justice Sotomayor filed a concurring opinion. Ralph Brubaker, Carl L. Vachetta, Professor of Law at University of Illinois College of Law, joins us today to discuss this ruling.
Hello, my name is Ralph Brubaker, and I'm the Carl L. Vachetta Professor of Law at the University of Illinois. In this podcast, I will briefly discuss a decision in January from the Supreme Court of the United States on an important issue of federal bankruptcy law in a case called City of Chicago v. Fulton. The case involved the relative rights of bankruptcy debtors and secured creditors in the collateral that secures repayment of a secured creditor, such as a car that secures repayment of a car loan. When the secured creditor has repossessed that collateral because of a default by the debtor and has possession of the collateral when the debtor files bankruptcy but has not yet sold the collateral, what does the debtor have to do to regain possession of the property? That is an important issue in the kinds of bankruptcy cases known as reorganization cases, Chapter 11 cases for corporations and Chapter 13 cases for individual wage earners. In those kinds of reorganization bankruptcy cases, the debtor remains in possession and control of the debtor's property and pays creditors out of the debtor's future income, including payment in full plus interest to secured creditors up to the value of the secured creditor's collateral. Well, in a very important Supreme Court decision, the Whiting-Pools decision in 1983, which was just a few years after enactment of the current bankruptcy law, the Bankruptcy Code, in 1978, the Supreme Court held that under the new Bankruptcy Code, the debtor could force the secured creditor who has repossessed its collateral pre-bankruptcy to return possession of that property to the debtor so the debtor can use that property in generating income to repay creditors. And the secured creditor is protected by the requirement that they're entitled to payment in full up to the value of their collateral, what the statute calls the right to adequate protection of the secured creditor's repayment right. So, for example, adequate protection in the case of a car loan might be a requirement that the debtor maintain insurance on the car and make periodic payments to the secured creditor such that the ratio of the loan balance to the value of the car stays roughly the same over time or decreases rather than increasing. And if the bankruptcy court finds that the debtor cannot adequately protect the secured creditor's repayment right, then the bankruptcy court has to allow the secured creditor to go ahead and sell its collateral and use the proceeds to pay down the debt. Well, the way that was all sorted out at the time the Whiting Pools decision was rendered is that if the bankruptcy debtor and the secured creditor could not agree on what was necessary to adequately protect the secured creditor, the debtor would have to file a request with the bankruptcy court for turnover of the collateral the secured creditor had repossessed, and in response, the secured creditor would assert its right to adequate protection. And the bankruptcy court would determine the necessary adequate protection in acting on that turnover request. That was a less than ideal process, though, because of the procedural rules regarding the turnover request. When the bankruptcy laws were being overhauled back in the 1970s, all of the procedural rules also underwent comprehensive revision. And it seems as though insufficient attention was paid to how those revisions affected these kinds of turnover proceedings. Before the revisions, turnover was done through a very expeditious process initiated by a simple motion or petition with a hearing before the bankruptcy court shortly thereafter, at which the court could resolve all of these issues in a fairly short period of time and order turnover conditioned on the debtor providing whatever adequate protection that the bankruptcy court decided was necessary. Well, the new procedural rules, perhaps inadvertently, changed that process to require a full-blown lawsuit in order to get turnover, which does not lend itself to expeditious resolution of these issues, which is an especially acute problem for a Chapter 13 individual debtor who needs his or her car, for example, in order to get to work to earn money to repay creditors through a Chapter 13 repayment plan. Well, I think that as a reaction to that procedural anomaly, debtors' counsel and the courts seized on a 1984 amendment to the automatic stay provision of the Bankruptcy Code as a workaround. So the automatic stay is a very powerful statutory injunction that stops creditors from proceeding with their debt collection efforts once a debtor has filed bankruptcy, so that they have to assert their rights only in the debtor's bankruptcy proceedings. So, for example, for the secured creditor who has repossessed its collateral but not yet sold it when the debtor files bankruptcy, the automatic stay prevents that secured creditor from going ahead and selling that collateral once the debtor files bankruptcy. Well, in 1984, the year after the Whiting Pools decision, which held that a debtor could get turnover of repossessed collateral, Congress amended the automatic stay provision to add a prohibition against taking any act to exercise control over the debtor's property once the debtor filed bankruptcy. Well, as applied to secured creditors who had repossessed collateral pre-bankruptcy, most courts said that by continuing to retain possession of that property once the debtor filed bankruptcy, the secured creditor was exercising control over the debtor's property in violation of the automatic stay. Thus, if they refused to immediately surrender possession of that property to the debtor once the debtor filed bankruptcy and demanded return, that creditor was willfully violating the automatic stay and could be subjected to contempt sanctions for violation of a federal court injunction. Well, that's a problematic process for turnover also, because it occurs without any court involvement at all in setting the adequate protection a secured creditor is entitled to. Right? The automatic stay goes into effect automatically, without any court order at all, the moment the debtor files bankruptcy. So that means that if the automatic stay compels immediate return of the repossessed collateral, the debtor does not have to offer up any adequate protection at all in order to get the property back, which can produce perverse incentives for a debtor to file bankruptcy without any hope or desire of even proposing a workable repayment plan, instead just filing bankruptcy to get the car back, and then abandoning or dismissing the bankruptcy case. Well, in the past few years, a couple of courts of appeals rejected the theretofore prevailing view that simply retaining possession of property violated the exercise control provision of the automatic stay. So the Supreme Court took the Fulton case to resolve that circuit split on whether the automatic stay immediately compels surrender of repossessed collateral once a debtor files bankruptcy. And the Supreme Court said no, the automatic stay does not compel immediate surrender of that repossessed collateral in a unanimous 8-0 decision in which Justice Barrett did not participate. And the Supreme Court's reasoning was essentially there is a fundamental difference between a stay and a mandatory injunction. A stay in legal terminology is commonly understood as a court order freezing the status quo. So it's a prohibitory negative injunction preventing any action that would alter the status quo, as distinguished from a mandatory injunction, which orders a party to take action altering the status quo. Well, not only does the bankruptcy's automatic stay use the term stay in the statute to describe all of its operative prohibitions, it's always been universally recognized as a status quo preserving type of injunction, whereas turnover has always been in the nature of a mandatory injunction entered by the bankruptcy court, ordering a party in possession of the debtor's property to relinquish possession. And in examining the text of the exercise control amendment to the automatic stay and the structure of the bankruptcy code more generally, particularly the relationship between the automatic stay provision and the code provision authorizing a turnover injunction, the Supreme Court was not convinced that the 1984 exercise control amendment was meant to fundamentally transform the automatic stay from a stay, a prohibitory negative injunction that simply preserves the status quo, into a mandatory injunction that compels alteration of the status quo, especially given the existence of the turnover provision of the bankruptcy code, which clearly does authorize the bankruptcy court to enter precisely that mandatory injunction, ordering surrender of possession of the debtor's property. So what that means as a practical matter then is we're now back to this very slow and cumbersome turnover procedure that requires a debtor to file a full-blown lawsuit to request turnover. As Justice Sotomayor pointed out in her concurring opinion in Fulton, though, that procedure can be changed by an amendment to the procedural rules through the established rulemaking process. And I fully expect that the rules regarding the turnover process will be changed to return to the more expeditious kind of process that prevailed before the 1970s. And in fact, I know that a proposal for such a change to the procedural rules has already been presented to the Advisory Committee for the Federal Bankruptcy Rules, and I'm hopeful that the Fulton decision will prompt a change in the turnover process that, in my opinion, is long overdue.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUSCast. SCOTUSCast is a project of the Federalist Society, a not-for-profit educational organization of conservative and libertarian law students, law professors, and lawyers, founded upon the principles that the state exists to preserve freedom, that the separation of governmental powers is central to our Constitution, and that it is emphatically the province and duty of the judiciary to say what the law is, not what it should be. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast series, including SCOTUSCast and Practice Group Podcasts, on iTunes or Google Play. For an archive of past podcasts, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at fedsoc.org/multimedia. That's fedsoc.org/multimedia.
This has been a FedSoc audio production.